This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia says its airstrikes have targeted a logistics center of the Ukrainian army near the city of Lviv, adding the center contained a large number of foreign-made weapons. Israeli warplanes conduct new strikes on Palestinian positions west of the city of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the besieged Gaza Strip. And a young Palestinian girl who was shot and injured by Israeli forces during last week's attacks in the occupied West Bank has succumbed to her injuries. Thank you for joining us. Our top story: as the war in Ukraine enters the third month, Russia's airstrikes have targeted a logistics center of the Ukrainian army near the city of Lviv. The Russian Defense Ministry says a large number of foreign-made arms were stored in the targeted Ukrainian logistics center. The ministry says a repair center for Dochka missiles in the city of Dnipro has also been destroyed. Meanwhile, the Pentagon says the first shipments of a new U.S. military aid package have arrived at Ukraine's border. Moscow had warned against unpredictable consequences if Washington continued supplying arms to Kiev. Ukrainian officials say Russian troops have taken control of the town of Kramina, situated in the eastern Donbass region, where Russian forces have reportedly started a new offensive. The Ukrainian president and local officials say Russia is seeking to destroy Donbass in the large-scale offensive it has begun there.
Russian troops are preparing for an offensive operation in the east of our country. It will begin in the near future. They want to literally finish off and destroy Donbass, destroy everything that once gave glory to this industrial region.
Volodymyr Zelensky once again called for more sanctions on Russia's energy sector. He said the need for an embargo on Russian oil is growing every day. The Ukrainian president said Russia is openly using energy to destabilize Western societies. Moscow has pointed the incriminating finger at European countries, saying their effort to cut dependence on Russian oil and gas would negatively affect the global market. Russia says there is no replacement for its gas in Europe under the current circumstances. Two British fighters captured in Ukraine by Russian forces have appeared on Russian state TV asking London to exchange them for a Ukrainian ally of the Russian president.
I remember seeing in the news when Viktor Medvedchuk was arrested for his political affiliations. If Boris Johnson really does care, like he says he does, about British citizens, then he would help pressure Zelensky to do the right thing and return Viktor to his family and return us to our families.
The other British fighter made the same plea before the camera, asking British Prime Minister Boris Johnson to arrange for his exchange. The two Britons, who have fought for the Ukrainian army in the port city of Mariupol, were referring to Viktor Medvedchuk, is the leader of Ukraine's opposition platform For Life party and an ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Earlier, Ukraine's security forces released video showing Medvedchuk asking to be swapped for, quote, defenders of Mariupol and its citizens. He made the appeal to both Putin and his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky. Medvedchuk has for many years advocated closer ties between Moscow and Kiev. We have talked to investigative journalist Tony Gosling in our special coverage of the war in Ukraine. He says Russia has managed to deal serious blows to the Ukrainian army so far.
Well, look, there's two things to say about this, really. One is the situation on the ground, and I suppose the other is the way it's been interpreted around the world, because different parts of the world are seeing what's going on in Ukraine in very different ways, because that's the way the media are spinning it. You know, it's very difficult to find balanced reporting, because most parts of the world are either on one side or the other. But what we've seen here in London on the British media is really appalling. But in our newspapers and on the television, really what we're getting is only one side, and it really is, it's almost like a full-on propaganda war is going on, almost like it's, say, World War II, the sort of propaganda we would have got in World War II, where it's all very one-sided. But on the ground, and I think, you know, obviously things will be won and lost on the ground. They won't just be, you know, in people's hearts and minds. And so the change in manoeuvre of tactics by the Russians does seem to, you know, there have been a few important changes in what they've done, because they've succeeded in the first part of their plan, I think, which was basically to separate and break up the Ukrainian army so that it couldn't really communicate and it couldn't move as one against Russia and to attack on many fronts.
Palestinian resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip say their air defences repelled intruding Israeli warplanes that targeted an area in the south of the besieged enclave. Israel says the airstrike came in response to a rocket fired into the occupied territories from Gaza. Earlier, we were joined by Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent in the Gaza Strip, for more details.
Israeli fighter jets have attacked an area in this west of the southern Gaza Strip, town of Khan Yunis, close to the Mediterranean. That location belongs to Hamas's military wing, the Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades. The bombing took place while Palestinians in Gaza were just getting ready to have their pre-dawn meals to prepare for the fasting for the holy month of Ramadan. In recent weeks, the Israeli regime has escalated attacks on Palestinians, whether in Al-Quds, in the occupied West Bank, or Gaza. Historically, the Israeli regime increases attacks on Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan. We have also to remember that last year, during the month of Ramadan, that was the 11-day Israeli war on Gaza, where scores of people were killed and injured, including dozens of children and women. And also earlier on Monday, Israeli tanks made a limited incursion east of the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. And also tonight, a young lady in the occupied West Bank succumbed to her wounds, who she was shot earlier by Israeli forces. So we see in recent weeks dozens of Palestinians being killed by Israeli regime forces, an increase in the hostilities against the Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, in Al-Quds, and especially in Al-Quds as Palestinians. Palestinians are observing the holy month of Ramadan, which is one of the holiest months of the Islamic calendar.
Well, as Ashraf noted there, a young Palestinian girl who was shot and injured by Israeli forces during last week's attacks in the occupied West Bank has succumbed to her injuries. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 18-year-old Hanan Mahmoud Khadour succumbed to gunshot wounds she sustained during an Israeli raid in the city of Jenin. A spokesman for the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas described the killing as a heinous crime. He said the Zionist regime will not be able to undermine the determination of the Palestinian people in their struggle to achieve their legitimate rights. The northern West Bank city of Jenin, particularly its refugee camp, is known as a stronghold for an emerging armed resistance movement. Since earlier this month, Israeli forces have been attacking the camp as well as other cities in the occupied West Bank. The raids have left a large number of Palestinians dead or wounded, while causing a sharp escalation in tensions across the occupied territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has held a gathering in the Lebanese capital Beirut to commemorate Palestinian Prisoners' Day. Speakers from resistance groups have stressed that armed resistance is the only hope for liberating prisoners and Palestine. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh has attended the event and filed us this report.
Dozens of people gathered in the Lebanese capital Beirut to mark Palestinian Prisoners' Day, a day when resistance factions and their supporters stand in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails.
On this day, which marks the Day of Palestinian Prisoners, I am certain that the people of the Arab and Muslim worlds, as we see in this gathering, will show the true unity with the resistance and the path of the resistance, especially with the issue of the prisoners and Al-Quds, which are the emblem of the Palestinian struggle.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that one cannot be truly with Palestine if they are not with the resistance.
It has become clear that whoever is with Palestine should be with the resistance. Anyone who has declared that he is with Palestine but hasn't taken one practical step in supporting the resistance is not truly with Palestine. Military resistance comes first. The other forms of resistance back and help to serve the actual resistance with arms.
He recalled that after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, late Imam Khomeini took the decision to close the Israeli embassy and reinstate the Palestinian embassy before declaring he was with Palestine. Liberating Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails has become a struggle for all resistance factions as it is linked directly to the Palestinian cause. They stress that liberating prisoners can only be realized completely by liberating Palestine. Officials of Palestinian resistance groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad considered that history has proven that only armed struggle can be a path to liberating both Al-Quds and the prisoners who continue to suffer from Israel's aggressive policies. More than 4,400 Palestinian prisoners are currently held in Israeli jails. Minors and women are among 500 detainees under the so-called administrative detention policy, under which they are held without charge or trial for an indefinite time period. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's army has held a military parade to mark the National Army Day. The parade, held annually on April 18, featured the latest indigenously produced military equipment of the army. Addressing the event, Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi said the Iranian armed forces will target, quote, the center of the Zionist regime if it makes the slightest move against the Islamic Republic. Yusuf Jalali has more from the venue of the parades in Tehran.
Heavy stumps of marching soldiers and convoys of Iranian-made weapons paraded in Tehran and across the country on the National Army Day. All of the four branches of the military took part in the key parade, held at the presence of army officials and Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi. Addressing the ceremony, the president hailed the army's achievements despite the U.S. sanctions.
The defense industry fared the best amid the sanctions atmosphere. The Islamic Republic's army achieved significant capabilities during this period. Not only did the army defend the nation during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, but it has stood with the people and for the people in all areas.
The parade featured the latest military achievements and weapons produced by the Iranian army, including radars, tanks, armored vehicles, drones, fighter jets, and missiles. This year's highlights were FAT-360 surface-to-surface missile, Labeg precision strike rockets, and Dezful and Majid air defense systems. The Islamic Republic says it produces over 80% of its needed military hardware indigenously. In his address to the parade, the Iranian president said the country's show of power sends messages both to friends and enemies.
The preparedness of the army sends the message of hope to the friends of the Islamic Republic. There's also a message to the enemy. The enemy must know that the military might of our armed forces gives us a deterrent power. They must know that the smallest move made against our country and our nation would be monitored by the sharp eyes of our armed forces.
The National Army Day was designated in 1980, following a historic speech by late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. There, he thanked the army for its role in the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution by announcing neutrality in the conflict between the former Pahlavi regime and the revolutionaries.
4 decades of arms embargoes have denied Iran access to even a bullet from other countries. The army says the parades today show that those bans have not harmed Iran's military capability. But in fact, they've been a blessing to stay prompted Iran to build up its own military arsenal so that its security is no longer tied to foreign arms. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Earlier we were joined by journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier. He says U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran over the past 4 decades have only strengthened the country's military capabilities.
It is true that the U.S. Sanctions started on Iran since 1979 by President Jimmy Carter at the beginning of the Islamic Revolution. What is also true that all these years, I mean, more than 40 plus years so far, all these sanctions have strengthened Iran's capability and reliance on itself domestically in rebuilding its strength, its armament, its defense system, and also its local production. If you look at the Iran-Iraq war that was imposed on Iran in the 80s, we realized that Iran had almost nothing at that time and managed throughout the years to build this capability to the point that today we've seen last month, for example, it has bombed the location of the Israeli Mossad in Kurdistan, Iraq. Therefore, it is also standing against the Israelis in the naval battle in different places around the Middle East, imposing deterrence, and all that is due and thanks to the capability that Iran managed to build.
Iran's foreign minister has called on the acting Taliban government to take necessary measures to protect Tehran's diplomatic missions and staff in Afghanistan. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a phone call with the acting foreign minister of the Afghan interim government, Amir Khan Muttaqi. The top Iranian diplomat said the two countries' enemies seek to cause tension in the relations between Iran and its eastern neighbor through fake propaganda. He said Iran has hosted millions of Afghans over the past 4 decades and pursues a positive and constructive approach to Afghanistan. Muttaqi, for his part, expressed regret over the recent attacks on the Iranian diplomatic premises in the capital, Kabul, and the eastern city of Herat. He assured Amir Abdullahian about the security of Iran's diplomatic missions and staff in Afghanistan. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Leading up to and after the Russian special military operation in Ukraine beginning on February 24th, the United States and its allies within the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, and the European Union have imposed unprecedented sanctions against the Russian Federation. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article penned by Aba Yomi Azikive, the editor of the Pan-African News Wire. The piece is titled, Western Sanctions Against Russia Create Food Deficits Globally. Please stay with us. Relations between Washington and Moscow have been strained for many years since the Russian Federation emerged from a period of serious decline in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. From the period of Bolshevik Revolution of October 1917 to the advent of the U.S. intervention in the European theater of operations during the Second World War, the character of relations between the capitalist states, including the U.S. and the Soviet Union, were viewed as a struggle between two differing and opposing social systems. Even in the post-Soviet era of the last decade and a half, there are conflicting interests that have driven both world powers to the current conflict in Ukraine. The rise of the Cold War in late 1940s aggravated the tensions which were somewhat submerged in the years of 1941 to 1945. Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941 and later that same year declared war on the U.S. as a response to the December 7th Japanese military attacks on Pearl Harbor in occupied Hawaii. On an international geostrategic level, the Soviet Union and the U.S. found themselves on the opposite sides of the political spectrum. In Africa, Asia, and Latin America, the Soviet Union supported the national liberation movements and those independent governments seeking to build an anti-imperialist and socialist orientation, while the Pentagon supplied weapons to the colonial fascist forces in Portugal, Rhodesia, and apartheid South Africa, to suppress the mass guerrilla revolutionary organizations, the Soviet Union and other socialist states such as China, Cuba, North Vietnam and North Korea provided political and material assistance to the movements seeking to overturn the legacy of colonialism. In today's global situation, absent the Soviet Union and its allied states in Eastern Europe, the U.S. is attempting to expand the presence of NATO. This is taking place in Europe as well as other geopolitical regions. Throughout Africa, the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, and Operation Barkhane, coordinated by France, has initiated military campaigns under the guise of fighting terrorism. Nonetheless, in several West African states, governments are turning to President Vladimir Putin and Russian military apparatus to approach the security crisis from another perspective. As it relates to the sanctions imposed by Washington, Wall Street and their allies in Europe, the impact is being felt internationally. In the U.S., the prices of fuel, food, transportation, housing, and utilities are rising rapidly. These price increases are in part due to the mismanagement of the economy stemming from COVID-19 pandemic. However, the instigation of a war between Russia and Ukraine has worsened the economic situation of workers and oppressed peoples in the U.S. and around the world. With specific reference to the African continent, countries such as Somalia, Benin, Egypt, Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, Senegal, and Tanzania are being adversely affected by the market disruptions caused by sanctions and the war in Ukraine. In fact, the level of Russian and Ukrainian wheat imports to Africa far exceeds those of the U.S. by nearly 500%. Consequently, the sanctions against Russia and the constant shipping of weapons to the pro-NATO regime in Kiev is serving as a mechanism to intensify the economic war aimed at the destabilization of Moscow. Yet this renewed Cold War policy is effectively creating the conditions for starvation of hundreds of millions of Africans and others throughout the globe. According to a report published by Al Jazeera on the burgeoning food supply crisis, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization FAO said its food price index, which tracks monthly changes in international prices for a basket of commodities, averaged 159.3 points last month, up 12.6% from February. As it is, the February index was the highest level since its inception in 1990. FAO said the war in Ukraine was largely responsible for the 17.1% rise in the price of grains, including wheat and others like oats, barley and corn. Together, Russia and Ukraine account for approximately 30 and 20% of global wheat and corn exports, respectively. Although the Western corporate media outlets make it appear as if the new sanctions being imposed on Russia almost on a daily basis have no effect on people living in the US and the NATO countries, this could not be further from the truth. Even in the US, working people, youth, seniors, people living with disabilities and marginalized oppressed communities are suffering immensely from the rising prices for essential commodities and services. As far as the administration of President Joe Biden is concerned, there has been no systematic policy initiatives to address the rapidly rising inflation. A plan to release oil supplies from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in the U.S. has not had any significant impact on easing the financial stress facing consumers. In addition, European countries are facing a monumental energy crisis with the restrictions being placed on the importation of Russian-produced oil and natural gas. Food products are scarce and expensive, while real income due to the rise in inflation is in significant decline. There is a direct link between the costs associated with energy, transportation, and food supplies. In underdeveloped regions of the world, the problems stemming from Ukraine war and the sanctions imposed by imperialist states take on acute proportions. The rise in prices for imports of refined energy resources and food will only drain national treasuries and household incomes of workers and farmers. Media reports in the corporate and capitalist government-controlled agencies suggest that the operation by Russia into Ukraine was unprovoked. Yet the Russian government for years has warned about the military actions of NATO in Eastern Europe. Successive administrations, both Democratic and Republican, have identified Russia along with China as principal enemies of the U.S. and its people. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in his travels to Europe, only serves to further extend the war in Ukraine. The United Nations, as an ostensible multilateral institution, has failed miserably, reflecting the destructive role that the White House plays in undermining its effectiveness in preventing international conflicts that have the potential to result in the use of nuclear weapons. The economic insecurities experienced by millions within the U.S. are a direct result of the failed policies of the capitalist system. Working people and the oppressed are forced into ever-declining standards of living, while corporate profits soar alongside the growing military-industrial complex, which annually expropriates larger amounts of the surplus value generated by labor. Anti-imperialist and anti-war forces in the U.S. and the NATO countries must reject the militarist policies that only benefit defense manufacturers and Wall Street. The wealth siphoned off through endless wars of aggression and international conquest could be utilized to rebuild the world system based upon mutual interest and sustainable security.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atar, the host of this program. This series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, also known as Imam Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Ali and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
So, and Shaykh Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, very recently, in one of the speeches of Imam Khamenei, he talked about a very important concept, which is Jihad al-Tabyin. And so many people in Iran, inside Iran and outside Iran, were shocked by this, we can say, type of look at the world and at the concept of jihad. Because this is the first time that this term has been coined by the rahbar and he used it. So now there are so many, we can say, explanations, commentaries and interpretations written on this concept. Of course, rahbar in his speech gave us a very nice framework for Jihad al-Tabyin. But this is good to be more familiar with this concept, maybe for the English-speaking people all around the world through this radio show, Viewpoints. And I think the picture that the rahbar is giving us is bigger than the Islamic Republic of Iran. He's talking about the whole Muslim lands of having this type of jihad in their mind, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. Because, obviously, Supreme Leader and all the jurists, obviously, they have control over the whole history of the Muslim Ummah. What we can see is that the cause of the failure of the believers throughout the history, when we look at the history, it was because that the Muslims were, they were degraded or their will was harmed. The righteous people's will, which they had, like we say irada,
yes.
Generally we use the word irada, yes. or the will that they, yes. had in order to perform something, in order to perform their rituals, in order to follow, mm-hmm. the Islam, okay. It was harmed. Mm-hmm. There can be many reasons for that, yes. And that refers to the tabiyin, that refers to the explanation or elaboration or the identification and the clarification, okay. As brother said,
yes.
We can see in the history, for example, in the Battle of Uhud, what happened is, mm-hmm. the Muslims, some Muslims, they did not follow the order of the Prophet. Yes. That was one of the reasons. Why? Because they were weakened. They have confusion in their minds.
That's right.
Okay? Yes. They did not follow it properly.
Yes.
So they were not explained what they need to do, and they were not clear about their stance.
Okay.
So they did not follow the Prophet. That's the first thing.
The clear argument and proof of Prophet Muhammad has been over there, but this was the...
Yes,
neglected.
It was their own,
yes,
own obviously.
Okay.
It was their own,
yes.
self,
yes.
that they did not have absorbed those things. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, obviously, it goes back to that they underestimated the orders of the Prophet.
Yes.
That's what we do in today's world. You know, we underestimate the orders of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
In the month of Ramadan, we see many people like they do not fast.
Okay.
Some people, they do not observe hijab. Mm-hmm. The men, they go with the non-mahram.
Yes.
So these are underestimating the rules and the, we can say, like the promises of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
And that's why the Supreme Leader is using the word jihad, mm-hmm. because it also refers to the jihadic akbar.
That's right.
Which is the greater jihad.
Okay.
On the other side, we can see like this war, the war at the time of Imam Ali. We can see Muawiyah and Abu Sufyan, the people like them, they were pretending to be Muslims, mm-hmm. where they were not the true Muslims.
Yes.
And they changed the whole scenario.
That's right.
Imam Ali had many wars. Why he had, as the Imam of the Ummah, why he had so many wars? Mm-hmm. Whereas our brothers also accept him as a Khalifa, yes. Caliphate. So
you mean Jihad al-Tabi'in is the continuation of the path of Prophet Muhammad,
yes.
and the Ahlul Bayt. And this has been practiced by all of them, isn't it?
And the main duty is because, the Supreme Leader has given this speech in front of those who were like involved in the Arba'een and the groups that mourn for Imam Hussein. And there were people who recite the Noha and all those. Because they recite those who go to the, pulpits,
yes.
those who deliver lectures, those who have impact on the or effect,
yes.
on the people,
yes.
Who can impress people, it was in front of them.
Yes.
And that's why the Supreme Leader has said, tell the truth. Tell the right thing to the people so they can accept it through you.
That's
so
right.
All these things goes back because this is very important. that we can see, like, if today the Muslim Ummah is feeling that they're backward, it is because they have accepted throughout the time that the Europe or the West is developed and they are undeveloped.
Yes.
And it was Imam Khomeini who came and he changed the thought. He said the ones who are developed, the ones who are advanced, is those who know from where they came, where they are, when they, and where they will go.
Okay.
Whereas the others do not know. So these kind of things, obviously, this was the war of narrations, as brother has mentioned.
Narratives.
Narratives, yes.
Yes, narrative is the war of narration, yes.
That it has put in our minds that we are backward, we are third world countries,
yes.
And we have seen that when Russia attacked Ukraine,
yes.
There were people who came who said, like, this is not Syria, this is not Iraq.
Okay.
Why they're saying this? Why they're saying, like, there are white people who are getting being killed.
Yes.
They are blue-eyed people. Why they're mentioning these things? It's because...
Nowadays, we could see it too, that in the Ukraine war, you know, the war you see, the war versus you do not see.
Yeah.
Have you seen the pictures, you know?
And
there have been good pictures, you know, comparing the war scenes in Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria with those in Ukraine. It says, this is the war you see, and these are the wars you don't see, okay? Right.
And on top of that, you know, we have seen, like, there are many... videos or films from the from Palestine, which they have replaced as Ukraine.
Ukraine, yes.
So this is what media is doing, and that's what Supreme Leader is saying.
Yes, the soft
because
war.
the media is in the wrong hands.
Yes,
and it is our duty with today's media or the things that we have in our hands, the sources that we have. We need to come and we need to clarify, we need to explain the world, what is right and what is wrong, so that everyone can come back to the right path.
That's all right. The explanation, I mean, this jihad of for Tabin or of clarification, Brother Ali, for sure follows some values or we can say some pivots. What are they? I mean, what is this jihad of Tabin based on? Because some people might say that the Islam that you are talking about based on the viewpoints of your rahbar might be a specific type of definition out of the religion of Islam. And there are so many denominations, sects that they have their own interpretation and commentaries on the concept of jihad and tabin or something like that. Let's talk about the values, I mean the roots, the basis on which jihad and tabin is based.
Sure. So basically when you look at this whole phenomenon of jihad and tabin, yes, everybody's going to have their own definition and their own understanding.
Yes.
I was looking at some analyses and some people, you know, the way they are putting it forth, some good people, is very general in terms. But if you look at what the leader has said, and if you zoom in, it is very obvious that the pivot and the axis of this jihad tabyeen is the Islamic revolution and the Islamic system. We cannot leave it open-ended because Tabyeen has always been there, like you pointed out earlier, and Sayyid has also alluded to it, that, you know, the prophets and imams, you know, they were doing Tabyeen.
Yes.
You know, they were explaining things to people. Whether they were getting it or not, you know, the people, the prophets and imams, they were doing their own thing.
Yes.
So it was there. We cannot leave it open-ended. Yeah. It has to be very carefully dissected. The leader is very clear on the point that the focus and the axis and the pivot of this jihad tabyeen is the Islamic revolution and the Islamic system. Secondly, the values and principles of the Islamic revolution.
Okay.
Right? If you remember in Gamedovum in Kalab Islami,
second phase of
in the second phase of the Islamic revolution, that manifesto that was released by Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei on the anniversary, I think it was the 42nd anniversary of the Islamic revolution. No, 40th. 40th anniversary of the Islamic revolution.
Yes.
It highlights this fact too, the principles of the Islamic revolution. You know, sometimes we get carried away with the details, the operational details. Let's go back to the drawing board, right? Mm-hmm. What are those guiding principles that Islam has provided, and based on that, Imam Khomeini brought about this revolution, right? Along with his comrades.
Okay.
So this is something that needs to be defended, and not just defended, explained. Okay. Because, you know, just a very quick tangent here. Mm-hmm. Some people say that it was a nationalistic revolution. Why do they say that?
Okay.
Because we have not done the duty of Tabyeen.
Yes.
we have not explained the value system of the Islamic Revolution that it was brought about on.
Yes.
The principles, the golden principles, which come from Islam, by the way.
Yes.
Right? They're not self-made. Okay. We have not explained it. So today people are confused. Some people. Mm-hmm. And of course the propagandists, they try to use this against us, that it was a nationalistic revolution in Iran. Iranian people fought for their country. What do you have to do with it? No, we have everything to do with
by
it.
By the same token, there have been so many personalities during the history who were doing jihad at-tabyin, okay? It could be, for example, even our Sunni brethren who talked against colonialism and imperialism, okay? It could be, for example, a colored brother from the U.S. who talked against, for example, slavery, Shahid Malcolm X, for example, okay? They have been all doing their great work in order to clarify what the soft war is.
See, when you look at the concept of tabyin itself, right? It was there. It was there for 1,400 years, and even before, right?
Yes. Okay.
But when the leader floats a term,
giving a model.
Terminology, he is making it very particular, right?
Okay.
In this time and age, he means something very specific
with it, right?
Yes, if you look at the dictionary meaning of tabyin, you can say all of them were tabyin, right? But what leader is doing is he's making it very specific, you know? And we have this concept, we have this whole trend in Islam too. So before, Prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala called this praying that we do ritual prayers, salah, it had a dictionary meaning before that. You know, dua, all of these things had a dictionary meaning before that.
Yes.
But when Prophet talked about it, he gave it a very specific misdaq and manifestation of that, right?
Okay.
So in short, pure Muhammad and Islam is the pivot and axis.
Yes. And do you believe this? I mean, when we talk about...
As a value?
As a value, yes. I mean, what are the values?
It is definitely a value. Okay. Obviously, when we talk about the values of jihad at-tabyin or any jihad in the Islamic world, the first thing is obviously, as brother has said, that the following the pure Muhammadan Islam, that's the basis.
Okay.
And believing in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Other than that, being the follower of the wali of the society, the ruler of the society, which is wali faqih at the time. In the occultation of the imam of the time, in the ghaibat of imam, it is the wali faqih, which is wali amrul muslimin, we call him the supreme leader or the leader of the Muslim ummah or the imam of the Muslim ummah. Not only by heart, but logically as well. Intellectually. So we need to believe in him logically and by heart and then follow him.
Okay.
It is not enough to just know him, okay, logically, the proofs that he's the best leader. No, you need to accept it by heart. Qalbi wa fikri. You know, these are the two terms.
But I think the
Persian
status and the position is more important than the very character, isn't it?
Yeah,
because
the status.
Yes,
actually,
the status,
we need to believe in the status, not
status,
the personality.
Yes. Okay.
Obviously, the status brings the, you know, the value to the person, basically.
Because this line has to be continued.
Yes.
I mean, next person comes, you know, next value.
So if I can quickly interject, right?
Okay.
Yes, the value of the position is obvious, right? But the person in a given time and place, and in a given era,
the person,
of course, has the equal importance, right?
Yes, I know. But so, I do want to say, if the people does not believe in the concept itself, and rather see it in the very personality, then if the personality is moved its rank or passes away or something like that, then the concept will not remain intact.
It is the same like when Imam Khomeini passed away, many people were not ready to accept Imam Khamenei as the Waliya Faqih.
Right.
So it is very important to first believe in the place and the concept.
And there are many today that who believe in this whole concept of Wilayatul Faqih, and they cannot deny it. But when it comes to the misdaq of it, being Hazrat Agha, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, they step back.
So it is important to have this. Number two, when we have this belief, number two, you need to follow him, follow his path. Whatever he says, you need to just follow it. The third thing is, as brother has said, benefiting from the Islamic and revolutionary teachings. Not only Islamic, because there's the Islamic teachings was there for 1400 years. But Imam Khomeini came with the revolution and he taught us how to follow an Islamic revolution. And that's why the Supreme Leader also has said, I'm revolutionary. What does it mean? It means that you do not stop where you are. You need to just advance. So,
and this revolution itself, the term in English language, you know, has its negative connotation. But in here, we do mean by revolution, you know, acting against falsehood, taqut, bottle, okay, and all of that.
Yeah.
And it is not only limited to, for example, the Islamic revolution of Iran against the previous Shah of Iran, okay? It is not. The Shah was the mastaq of the taghut, so yeah. There are so many taghuts now around the world, in the Western world, even in the Eastern world, okay, that there are examples of the taghut, so your revolution is against them, okay?
So the important thing is obviously the Islamic revolution itself at the time, in today's world, because we have the example, a clear example, a live example in front of us.
Yes.
And all our activities in Jihad-e-Tabiyyin should be in line with the Islamic revolution.
Mm-hmm.
If it is not in line with the Islamic revolution, then we are doing something else. Then we are not performing the jihad of clarification, as brother said,
yes.
or explanatory.
Okay.
This is I think...
Right. We are done with the time. Okay, we have 1 minute.
This is by far a very important point, right? That this has to be looked at in the proper context of the term, right? Today, you know, just to give you a litmus test, right? How do you know if you're acting in line with the Islamic revolution or not? Well, jihad, of course, is always against the enemy,
mm-hmm.
right? There has to be enemy.
Yes.
So... And we're going to talk about this in future programs too. You look at the enemy. Where is the enemy attacking? If you are responding to the enemy, if you are defending Islam and Muslims against the enemy, then it is Jihad-e-Tabiyyin. And if you're not, then like Sayyid said, you're doing something else.
Yeah.
It could be good something else, but you're doing something else.
You're attacking the wrong point.
You're doing something,
point.
But
yeah.
not Jihad-e-Tabiyyin.
Yeah. That's right. Okay. That's right. So there's a lot to say about the methodology. I mean, how to do it and what is the correct methodology of doing that. They're all still, you know, unanswered. We do not have time for that in this episode. We have to shift it to the other episode. But thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen and Sheikh Ali, for a nice explanation regarding Jihad-e-Tabiyyin and its definition. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
For the majority of Americans who are so poor they barely have to pay income taxes, Scott's plan is just the latest in a 40-year barrage of assaults and insults coming from the GOP, says Tom Hartman, writer, in an article published under the heading, "The GOP is actually running on raising taxes on the poor and destroying medicine and Social Security." Here's the story. Republicans want to raise taxes on poor and working-class Americans, and Social Security and medicine, jack up pollution and corporate profits, all while continuing to pamper their billionaire donor base. This time, it's the guy in charge of getting Republican senators elected and re-elected, Florida Senator Rick Scott. You may remember him as the guy who ran the company convicted of the largest Medicare fraud in the history of America, who then took his money and ran for governor of Florida, where he prevented the state from expanding Medicaid for low-income Floridians for all the years he ran the state. Now he's the second richest guy in the Senate. And IMHO, the leading candidate for the GOP nomination for president in 2024. And true to form, he is echoing the sentiments of the richest guy in the Senate, Mitt Romney, the last guy before Trump to have that nomination. Ron said of Obama voters back in 2012, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food and housing. You may name it. There are people who pay no income tax. Low-income working people in America generally pay a higher percentage of their income as taxes than do most of U.S. billionaires and multi-millionaires. They pay Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, taxes in the form of fees for everything from a driver's license to road tolls to annual car inspections. As Romney pointed out, though, about 47% of Americans in 2012 made so little money that after applying the standard deduction, they paid no income tax. This doesn't just reveal how few people pay taxes, though. To the contrary, it reveals how many Americans are living in or on the edge of poverty. The simple reality is, if you want more people to pay income taxes, all you have to do is raise working people's pay. We saw this in a big way between 1950 and 1980 when Keynesian economics reigned and labor unions held wages, and the taxes they paid steadily rise for working people. But Republicans don't like the idea of what they call wage inflation. They'd rather just squeeze working people harder while continuing their subsidies of the lifestyles of the morbidly rich donor class. More than half of Americans make so little money from their employment that they can't deal with an unexpected $1,000 expense like a car accident or medical bill. And it's these very people who Rick Scott and the GOP believe need to be further taxed so they will have what Scott calls skin in the game. In the early years of the Reagan administration, before his neoliberal trickle-down and supply-side policies started to really bite Americans, only 18% of Americans were so poor and their income didn't qualify to be taxed. As a right to work for less laws spread across America and Republicans on the Supreme Court made it harder for unions to function, more and more working people fell below the tax threshold. Today, it takes two working adults to maintain the same lifestyle that one worker could provide in 1980. So an estimated 61% of working Americans this year will make so little pay that their income isn't subject to taxation. Rick Scott and the GOP's solution to this situation isn't to raise the income of working class people. Quite to the contrary, they are suggesting that low-income people should be hit with their very own income tax, in addition to the dozens of other taxes they're already paying. Also, multimillionaires and billionaires like Scott and his friends can hope to see their own taxes go down a tiny bit. Doing his best imitation of New Gringich, Scott has rolled out his 11-point plan to soak the American middle class, lock down elections, destroy consumer protections, increase pollution and climate change, and squeeze a few more dollars out of every family, no matter how tight their budgets may already be. Scott calls this rescuing America, and it may be true if you're morbidly rich and made your money spewing pollution or hustling opioids. His plan not only calls for a 50% cut in the IRS workforce, presumably to end all audits of rich people like Scott, but also demands all federal legislation to sunset within 5 years. That would almost certainly end Social Security and Medicare programs that have been in the crosshairs of Republicans since Reagan's day. Realizing how raising taxes on 60% of Americans' voters will play in campaign ads, Mitch McConnell has backed away from Scott's bizarre proposal. But Fox News is all over it, inviting Scott on repeatedly to hawk his plan and prepare the ground for his candidacy. After all, billionaires like Rupert Murdoch and his family need their tax breaks. As Sean Hannity told Scott during a recent appearance, "I want to applaud you. I'd like to see the House and the Senate come together on these issues, make these promises to the American people, get elected, and then fulfill those promises." No doubt, multimillionaire Hannity was speaking his own voice. But for the majority of Americans who are so poor, they barely have to pay income taxes, Scott's plan is just the latest in a 40-year barrage of assaults and insults coming from the GOP.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.